Sri Vrindavan Dhama ki, Sri Mayapur Dhama ki, Ganga Maya ki, Jamuna Maya ki, Bhakti Devi ki, Tulasi Devi ki, Samaveta Bhakti Vrinda ki, Jainitai Gaura Premati. All glorious the Samadavatis, all glorious the Samadavatis, all glorious the Samadavatis, all glorious to Sri Guru and Sri Gauranga, all glorious to Srila Prabhupada. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya.
Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya.
Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya.
Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya.
Once when devotee, he was giving class. He was giving class, and then all the devotees were coming. First day, you know, packed full, you know, and one or two of the recording things. Then the next day, less devotees, more recording things. Then the next day, then even less, until there was like a couple of devotees, and they were bringing all these tape recorders and putting them all out there. So then the next day, he came. He had taped the class beforehand on the tape. He came to the class, and when that devotee was setting up all the mics, he set up his. And like that, he turned on his thing and then left. And then like that. So he gave the class to the, like that. Sorry. I think that happened in Sydney, I think. So chapter 8, questions and answers in the first canto, chapter 8. Did you mention about Sautamash? You already told everyone?
No,
I think Maharaj is a little bit not feeling well today. He's been doing, you know, so much of the work and all that. Because see, originally he had done the work, as he explained, more simply. And then as he went through the cantos, then it started becoming more and more detailed. Because he found that that was the best way to actually express it, bring in much more purports and much more, you know, different aspects. So then, seeing that he had taken it to that level, then when we were going through these first chapters, then he felt that they needed to be redone. So he's been, you know, like that every day, just completely going through and redoing them and everything from what was before. So then sometimes he, you know, overworks. Chapter 8, the prayers of Queen Kunti, verses summarized. So this is question 13 and 14. Deeply bereaved, Lord Krishna and the Pandavas performed the funeral rites for their relatives killed in the battle of Kurukshetra. Krishna then prepares to leave for Dwarka. Suddenly Uttara, wife of the deceased hero Abhimanyu, rushes forward in fear, great fear, to beg Krishna's shelter. Ashwatthama had released a Brahmastra targeted to kill the unborn child within her womb. Krishna, as the Supersoul, covers the embryo from within and saves Uttara and Parikshit, her son-to-be. Describing this to Shonaka, Sutta remarks in verse 15 that Ashwatthama's weapon was so powerful, nothing material could resist or counteract it. But before the personal power of the personality of Godhead, the terrible Brahma Tejas of this weapon was completely nullified. So 1 through 16. Note, commenting on verse 13, Srila Prabhupada writes, here the word ananya vishyatmanam is significant. The Pandavas were 100% dependent on the protection of the Lord. Although they were all great warriors themselves, but the Lord neglects even the greatest warriors and also vanquishes them in no time. When the Lord saw that there was no time for the Pandavas to counteract the Brahmastra of Ashwatthama, he took up his weapon even at the risk of breaking his own vow. Although the battle of Kurukshetra was almost finished, still, according to his vow, he should not have taken up his own weapon. But the emergency was more important than the vow. He is better known as Bhaktivatsala, or the lover of his devotee, and thus he preferred to continue as Bhaktivatsala than to be a worldly moralist who never breaks his solemn vow. So this would show that the actual purpose of of all the rules and regulations of the Vedic culture is to establish and nourish relationship. Right? This is what it's for. Because otherwise, if it was the other way around, he would have kept his vow. And everybody would have thought that that was glorious. Right? That he kept his vow, he didn't take up, and nobody would have said anything. If Krishna had done nothing there to take up his weapon, then no one would have said anything because he had taken a vow. You know, and among Kshatriyas, their word is very important. You know, they would rather die than their word be broken. So therefore, for the Kshatriya class to break their word based on a relationship, that means great affection. So on the material platform, that wouldn't be considered nice, right? But on the spiritual platform, then that's rasa with Krishna, because that's the actual thing, is relationship with Krishna. Does that make sense? You know, because it's just like, even on relationship, I mean, there was one king, I forget the king. He was attacked by another king, went to battle. Somehow or another, he was routed and he retreated. And he came back home. And he came into the palace and told, you know, the person at the door, because the women have the inner palace, and said that the king is here, you know. And so when the queen heard that, she said, go ask him, did he win? And that. And so they went back and asked, and the king told the attendant, no, we had to retreat. So when the attendant came again, then she said, well, then that must be an imposter. It's not actually my husband. Because, you know, you have to be careful. Because if it was my husband, he'd either come back victorious or dead. You know, he wouldn't have just ran away from the battle. So then the attendant went back, told the king. So the king then got very enthused, went back out onto the battlefield, won the battle, and then came back. So it's like amongst the Kshatriyas, the word is so important, you know. Or we see Kunti. Kunti had mistakenly said, share what you have, you know, begged today amongst you all equally. You know, but then when they found out that that was Draupadi, they were just kind of like joking, you know, see what we beg today, because, you know, but she just offhanded said it. But the point was, if she had said it, it can't be made untrue. Right? She could have just said, oh, I was joking, and left it. But because of the Kshatriya code, then she wouldn't do that. Does that make sense? So we can see in such severe things of here, girl that's supposed to be the wife of Arjuna ends up as the wife of all of them, you know, or the queen is saying, you know, means I'd rather have a dead hero than a live coward, you know, then we can understand the Kshatriya code and the importance of vow and word. Does that make some sense? So, therefore, it is a very serious thing that Krishna, for the affection of his devotees and protection of his devotees, will break his vow. Right? In other words, we should not underestimate the significance of this. Otherwise, why is Prabhupada talking about it? So both when he picked up the chariot wheel to protect Arjuna, you know, in the fight with Bhishma, and in this with Ashwatthama, then we can see it's simply out of affection, because he is the protector of his devotees. Because everything is just a pastime, right? Does that make sense? The pastime is there to interact with his devotees. Killing the demons, that's a side thing. Maya can do that, you know. But interacting with the devotees, that he does himself. So it's actually very significant. So morality is the standard on ordinary, mundane dealings. They must be according to religious principle. They must be according to morality. Right? But in relationship with Krishna, sometimes morality is not, especially in an emergency, it's not the right thing. Does that make sense? You know, it's just like, example, I think it was, I forget what year it was, but it would have been early, you know, mid-60s. The devotees, because they would just go on Harinam and that, and you know, all the brahmacharis, brahmacharinis would just go together. And they went down, and they were doing Harinam in some place. You know, this would have been, I think, in New York. I think it was New York or it was Boston. Then somehow or another, the students were rioting, you know, because that was the days. It must have been during Vietnam War time. So they were rioting. And the riot police came out and that, and somehow or another, the devotees were kind of caught in the middle of it. And so the tear gas started going off. And then, you know, so the devotees, it's, you know, time to get out of there. But the tear gas affected one of the Matajis, and she fainted. So then they got to go. So then it's emergency, so one of the brahmacharis just picked up the lady, put her on his shoulder, and they ran back to the bus, got in, and that's, you know, like that, took care, and that was it. So one may say, well, according to principle, he shouldn't be touching the girl, this, that. But in an emergency, these things are there. Krishna would not be pleased that, okay, he maintained his vow, he didn't touch her, and then left her there in the middle of the riot, unconscious. You know, does that make sense? So in an emergency, then sometimes things change. As soon as the emergency's over, then it has to go back to normal. One can't continue that. That's also considered wrong. So in an emergency, you maintain the yama, the primary rule, when it doesn't apply, is wrong. But in the same way as when the yama can be done and you stick to the niyama, or the secondary, then that's also wrong. Does that make sense? Like that. So that's always one has to be careful. Yes?
I had a point in between. Ashwatthama was a brahmana. When brahmanas, they say something or do something, usually Krishna takes it as something to do.
Yeah, yeah.
But Ashwatthama did something wrong and Krishna stepped in it. Mm-hmm. So that was a very special thing. Usually he doesn't do that.
Yeah, that's true.
But Sringi, for example, Sringi will...
Sringi.
She didn't do anything at that time.
Yeah, yeah.
But another time...
Well, that's how we're hearing this. That's why we're sitting here. If he had counteracted Sringi. Pariksit Maharaj himself could have counteracted Sringi's curse. Because Sringi is a powerful Brahmin, but he's just a Brahmin. But Pariksit is a devotee. So they're much more powerful. As we could see, is Durvasa, so powerful, you know, then, you know, he's a partial, you know, incarnation of the Lord, you know, the element of the mode of ignorance. But he couldn't overcome Ambarish, and Ambarish was doing nothing, let alone if he had done something. You know what I'm saying? In other words, he wasn't making any endeavors, so that's a good point. Because right? Go Brahman Nihitaya Cha. Is that the what the Brahman says? But we also see in that is the Brahmastra did destroy the embryo, and then he put it, revived it. That way then both also Ashwatthama's determination was fulfilled, but at the same time it was thwarted. You know. So like that, Krishna's very expert. That was why his point was, is you have to maintain he has acted wrong. So he must be killed. But at the same time he's a Brahmin. You can't kill a Brahmin. So now you have to work the both out. So in the Dharma Shastra then there's a verse that says, because it all went throughout the point when it's dealing with punishment, Manu's making the point again and again to the kings that the king cannot corporally punish a Brahmin. You can banish him, but even when you banish him with all his stuff. He takes all, because you can't take, if you take his stuff, that's stealing from a Brahmin. And if you kill him, that's killing a Brahmin. Those are the two most, you know, those five main sins. You know, you can't get worse sins than that. You know, and that is also by accidentally killing a Brahmin, that's bad. So there is some atonement. But if you did it on purpose, there is no atonement. Like that. They don't even talk about what's going to happen to you. You know, they talk about what happens to you if you accidentally kill the Brahmin. Like that. But, you know, it's like if you strike him with a stick and draw blood, then for as many grains of dust that each drop of blood soaks up, for that many thousands of years, you'll suffer in hell. Right? So that's a lot of grains of dust and one drop of blood. And so if many drops, I mean, that's a lot. So they talk about what will happen to you if you do that, and that's if that you just hit him. You didn't even kill him. like that. And so killing him on purpose, then they don't. It's not even describable. So it's like, does that make sense? You know. So after making that very clear, then it mentions that they can be shaved, like that, shaved and banished. So then, from the hints of Krishna, then Arjuna understood. Okay, this is the way. It's equal to death because he's been how do you say? Yeah, humiliated. That's the word. He's been humiliated. So it's this, you know, so one who's been honored, dishonor is worse than death. So he's been killed by honor because it's also a secondary rule, because you have the main rule of killing of a Brahmin. That's obvious. But then you have secondary rules what are equivalent to killing a Brahmin. So one of them is defaming him. Like that. That's also equivalent to killing a Brahmin. Like that. So like that, then there's so many rules. Yes.
In the previous chapter, it is said that also depriving Brahman of his wealth is considered to be a punishment.
Yeah, but that would have to be in the way of a fine. That wouldn't be you take all of his stuff, because they don't take, you know. In other words, it's what he lives with and this and that. But if there's something, Brahmins can be made to pay fines. Mm-hmm. You know, like that, if they've done something wrong, and within that they could pay a fine. So here, basically, that would be depriving of wealth doesn't mean all wealth. You know, like a shudra does that, you might take all his stuff away. You know, because if you only take something away, then he'll gloat and think, hey, I got off easy. You know, like that. So it's according to the mentality of the person. So it's like the Brahmin, his day-to-day living shouldn't be inconvenienced. Because the point is, if he's actually a Brahmin, he's made a mistake, but then that means he's thoughtful and introspective enough to understand he's done wrong, and he knows why it's wrong, because he teaches the law. You know what I'm saying? Just because sometimes we take the thing, if he did something wrong, he never was a Brahmin, but that's not how the Vedic culture works. Someone is a practicing Brahmin, but because they're in the material world condition, they may make a mistake. It happens. It happens to Lord Brahma. So why it can't happen to anybody, any Brahmin, after him. Does that make sense? So sometimes we hear devotees say that if he did this, so he was never, so we can deal with him, you know, not as a Brahmin. But that's not supported by the Shastra. Point is, the Ashwatthama is a practicing Brahmin, obviously. Like that. Son of the teacher, you know, he was qualified. But somehow or another, you know, the death of his father and just the whole thing, and it just, he got off track. But as soon as it's there, then he gets on track, because they understand. Does that make sense? So it's a very, that's why it's something that's only supposed to be dealt with the kings, because the common people can't deal with it. You know, they can't deal. You know, righteousness to them is, they have to see exactly, you know. So it works like that. Eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, all this, it works like that. But with Brahmins, it's different, because they actually, once they get out of that emotional mood, they understand. But the problem is the Kshatriyas, tend to not get out of that emotional mood. Because the Brahmin's thing is forgiveness. So once he gets out of that emotional mood, he'll drop the whole thing. But Kshatriyas can't. You know, the example of, Uluka? No, Uk. The earrings?
Utanka.
Utanka. So when he went to the king saw he was such a qualified Brahmin, he said, you please accept the Shraddha offering. So then he agreed, but when they brought it, it was cold and it had a hair in it. And anything that's got a hair in it is considered food for paisachas and rakshasas, so the Brahmin can't accept it. You know, because this is being offered to them. It wasn't offered to Krishna, and then it's, you know, like that. Prasad, so you just take the hair out. This is that it's being offered to them as they are the medium through which it'll go to the forefathers, so they can't accept it. So he said, I can't take this. So the king, you know, he said, because there's a hair in it. So then I think the king cursed them that, you know, because you're not accepting my Shraddha offering, And that is being done because I am the son. I'm doing it for my father. Therefore, you will not have a son who will do a Shraddha rite for you. You know? And so then Utanka said, fine, and since you can't see the hair, what's the use of your eyes? So you might as well be blind. I curse you to be blind. So then, you know, then the king, you know, after that exchange is a little more serious, looks at it. There is a hair there. It is cold. He sends to the kitchen to find out why there's a hair in the food. They found out the lady that was cooking had her hair open. She didn't have it tied. So then, like that, so then, you know, all that was worked out. And so then the king says, you please forgive me, you know, for this mistake. And so then Utanka forgave him. And Utanka says, oh, now you forgive me. And he says, I can't, I'm a Kshatriya. I'm still burning with the thing of you've insulted me. Even though his king is absolutely 101% wrong and Utanka is not wrong in any way, he can't forgive. And then Utanka says, but you said because it was pure and no hair, and because there was no hair and I was saying there's a hair, therefore you cursed me. But there was a hair, therefore your curse won't work. So it doesn't matter anyway. But the point is the kings have a problem with that. That's why it's said, the Manu says, never insult a Kshatriya. Because they just have a very great problem. Means, in other words, if they're just on the material platform of forgiving. As a devotee, of course, because then by character they're Brahmins, so they can. You know. But their occupation, their natural occupation, is that of Kshatriya. But on the material platform, then it's very, very difficult. Yeah, very difficult.
Is this why Brahman can be spared, like Brahman's life can be spared, Kshatriya is better to kill Kshatriya?
It's generally, it means if it's the emperor like that, then it won't happen. You can't kill the emperor, you can't kill the king. When they talk about Kshatriya here, it means Kshatriya who's not a king. Because a Kshatriya, he just has a specific duty, someone else can do it. So if he does something wrong that affords that he should be killed, then he would be. But if he's the king, then it's a different thing. That's why they left Vena. Because he's the king, because he protects the whole kingdom. The single Kshatriya is only doing his particular aspect in the administration. Does that make sense? So here it also is different, and especially an emperor. That's why Sringi's father was made the point, is it's so sinful that he's cursed the emperor of the world. Like that. So, because they're, you know, sitting peacefully in their ashram and can do meditation is only because Parikit's the emperor. Like that. So he missed the whole point. Because we generally take Kshatriya as just across the board. Kshatriya means Kshatriya who's not sitting in the seat of the king. If you're sitting in the seat of the king, they're above these rules. Unless it gets too much, you know, when they actually start. If it's against small things, it's okay, but once they start going against Brahmins and breaking down religious principles like Vena, then they have to be removed. But, you know, other things, and it's not. Yes?
But the other day in class, I asked about the Kshatriyas. You explained that Kshatriya means king. I asked about the soldiers, that they are Shudras. So can you give an example of a Kshatriya who is not a king?
Yudhishthira is the king, and his brothers are Kshatriyas. So they're like ministers, they help, they assist, they have their areas.
Well, ministers can also be kings.
No, Kshatriyas, yeah. They can. Generally, they're Brahmins, but they can be anybody. The point is that the ministers have to be the most qualified person in the kingdom in that area. Generally, it would be a Brahmin. But if it's not, it can be a Kshatriya, it could be a Vaishya, it could be a Shudra. Like Vidura, he was the prime minister for Dhritarashtra. He's a Shudra. But there was no one more qualified than him in the law. So then it's there. So there is the point of the general social structure, but knowledge in that overrides these things. So that's the point, is that it would... Does that make sense?
Yeah. A landlord, is it a Kshatriya?
Landlord is a Vaishya. Is a king of Vaishyas. They may be that the Kshatriya, to maintain himself, is a landlord.
Because they call them Thakur.
Huh?
They call them Thakur. Thakur is a type of Kshatriya.
It may be that they're doing that, but they're living off of rent rather than tax. See, how you can tell the difference is the landlord that's on the border. Is that what is the reason they're taking the tax? You understand? Or the rent? Is it to protect the people that are on the land? Or is it their profit? Right? The king takes the tax to protect the people. The vaisya protects the people so that he gets tax. Right? If the dacoits are stealing from the people, he gets less tax. Right? If the people aren't being religious, they won't be getting as much return from their endeavors. Therefore, he can't tax them so much. Does that make sense? So that's the one borderline thing. It means the king has land, but he's giving that out to people and taking tax. The vaisya, it's his land, and he keeps it, control of it, and then he's taking, you know, either tax or, you know, some kind of rent from the people. It's slightly different. So it may be that the kshatriyas have come to that point where they're taking up that aspect of a vaisya's lifestyle. But it's, you know, it's still, you know, in times of distress they may do. You know, that's the natural thing, is that the kshatriya, if he can't do his duties as a kshatriya, would take up the duties of a vaisya. You know. And then it's generally business as opposed to agriculture. He could take it up, but if he has the opportunity, better a kshatriya takes up business than agriculture. Because agriculture is specifically for vaishyas and shudras. That's their right. Taking care of cows is an occupation, and farming. That's specifically the right of the vaisya. Business is a vaisya activity, but that's more general. So if a brahmin or kshatriya has to take up vaisya activities, then it's recommended better they do business, because it's more independent. Farming, you know, to make profit, you're dependent upon so many assistants and this and that, and, you know, so many restraints are there.
Which of the two vaishyas are higher, the one who's doing business or the one who's doing agriculture?
It's unfortunately a highly politically incorrect answer. See, because your bulk of vaishyas are going to be doing that anyway, the plowing and means the field, because that's naturally, they live in the village like that. But for a vaishya lives in the city, then naturally he would do business as opposed to agriculture. So it depends where they would be situated. Does that make sense? So if they're city people, they would do business. And if they're country people, then they would generally do farming. Though still, even in that, somebody has to do trade, because one village only produces certain amounts of goods. So either they're directly themselves trading it, or someone else trades it, you know, makes a business out of trading between villages. One village produces grains, another one produces cloth. You know, another one produces pots. You know, so like that, then they will naturally, you're going to end up with people who are in between. You know, they'll do the trade. Main thing of Vaishya is that he makes an endeavor to create economic development. That's the most important thing for him to do. Right? The Brahmin must study. You know, the Kshatriya must protect. The Vaishya must endeavor to create profit, and the Shudra must assist. That's the essence of what they're doing. You know, but it does say banking is considered low grade. That's not considered good. Like that. Okay.
Stock exchange also.
No, stocks is different, because you're buying and selling. Usury means that you're lending money and then taking profit off of them. But the problem is you're lending money, the person's in distress. So then to get your profit back, he doesn't have money. He borrows from you money, but it still means he still doesn't have money. So that means you have to use a lot of coercion and stuff to get your money. So that's why it's considered less, because your relationships with your customers is not nice. Right? You know what I'm saying? While if you are doing trade, then your dealings with your customers has to be nice, right? And if you're doing farming, then you're nice with your people and your cows, and you know, so relations go on. You're in a natural environment, and so it's also nice. So therefore, banking is considered the lesser of the Vaishya activities, like that. Didn't necessarily died, but his body was destroyed. No, he wasn't dead, but it did make some problem for his body, like that. You know how much exactly? That's. Yeah, but because the Brahmastra has to have some effect, it's been sent, but at the same time, it has to be neutralized. Is that okay?
The Brahmastra seems to be a personal weapon. It's like
they're all personal weapons.
It's the person itself.
All of the weapons are persons.
So how can it then be used by Ashwatthama, who only knows how to launch and not retreat it? So why did Brahmastra agree?
He was given to him. He was given by a bona fide Brahmin to a bona fide Brahmin, but that's all he knows, because it's not necessarily that you have to draw it back. You only have to draw it back if there's a problem.
But that means he didn't know fully how to deal with the Brahmin.
That's there, but, you know, he had that much. Normal thing is you just launch it and that's it. But here it's that because of the situation, then it needed to be called back. You know, so he wasn't fully learned in it. You know, so if his father hadn't taught him, then that wasn't necessarily... It may have been a fault on his part, but he was the most expert in celestial weapons. So it most likely was his father just didn't get around to it. You know, the battle came up. So he knew how to launch it and not pull it back. This has more of a detail. You know, it's just like, let's say, very funny. One time for the Mayapur Sankirtan party, they hired a guy. He was a bus driver in Calcutta for 30 years to drive one of the Sankirtan buses. So they thought, great, you know, this guy's very experienced. So then they found he was a great driver, but he could only go forward. He could not reverse the vehicle. He had no idea, because the city buses, they just go, right? There's no question. Everybody moves for them. And when they park it, they don't park it in a space like that. They just drive into the depot, put it into place, and then drive out again the next day. So 30 years, he had never reversed a bus. So he didn't even know how to, so like that. So he could drive the bus, but, you know... So it's the same way. He could, you know, the essential thing is he could launch it in attack, but you know, that's a subtle point, is to retract it, because how often do you have to retract it? Like in the whole war, we don't hear of anyone retracting any weapon. Does that make sense? Okay. Okay, so the whole point is it's a very delicate balance. That's why they were confused at Draupadi's, on the unveiling of Draupadi, because the religious principles are so complicated that they got confused like that. Because the point is if his husband has gambled her away, then they can do what they like. You know, so it's not wrong. But at the same time, then the Dharma Shastra says that you can't separate the wife from the husband, even if he sells her. Even if he sells her, she's still connected with the husband, and he's still her authority. You know, like that. And then, you know, then the point is, if he had the right to gamble her away, because if he's already lost, then she's lost with him. Right? She's not separated from him, because they're taking it. He's lost, and now she's lost. He's lost, so they're separated. But if they're separated, he doesn't have the right to gamble her anyway. You know. But the actual thing is, if he's lost, she's already lost. Because if he becomes a servant, then she's also a servant, but with him. But she's his wife. so no one can deal with her inappropriately. You know, she's not a maidservant who has no husband. Does that make sense? So a very fine point. So in the moment, you know, it means now we've discussed this over a few minutes. They didn't have a few minutes. It's just that second it just, you know, happens, and then they became confused. So the whole point is that the relationship in serving Krishna and with the devotees is more important than mundane morality for mundane morality's sake, right? Morality is important in that it's an element of the culture that's used for Krishna's service. But if Krishna's service is going to be affected by morality, does that make sense? Then, you know what I'm saying? Like you have some people come to the temple, and they're a whole thing on, let's say, you know, it's like you're in a Muslim country, and they come to the temple, you know, you have idols here, you're doing worship and that. No, no. Are we going to say, yes, yes, we're devout, you know, Hare Krishna Hindus, and we're doing the deity worship here, and, you know, yes, it is your right according to your law that now you can take us all away and kill us and take the deities and, you know, grind them into powder and this, and but we're upstanding, you know, devout, moralistic people, so you must do what you must do. No, we're going to say, no, no, like that. And they'll say, no, but what are these? And it says, you know, conversation pieces. You know, we picked them up in India. They're nice, you know. They just decorate the table. You're going to lie. You're going to flat lie. So if you told the truth there, that would not be Krishna conscious. That would in no way please Krishna or the Vaishnavas or anybody. Your moralism will send you to hell. And you sit there and flat, you know, lie, then that is actually Krishna conscious. Because Krishna's, you know, pleasure in that is what you're trying to gain. These other people don't understand, then they it's not worth it for them. It's not worth being moral for people who themselves don't actually know the standard. So you're moral with people who are moral. But with people who aren't moral, you can't necessarily be moral. Right? Unless by your being moral, it will maintain your position, you will come out on top. Like Yudhishthira, by his being moral, he comes out on top because of the power of the austerity and that. Right? In other words, you have to see is if a higher principle of religion is being broken by maintaining the lower one, then you're wrong. But if by maintaining the higher principle of religion or Sanatan Dharma over Varnashram Dharma, then it's broken. Does that make sense?
Yes. For the example you gave about Draupadi, the discussion was also there, you know, is a woman a possession of a husband so that he can do the weather anything that she likes, or is she an individual? So, personally, I don't understand the answer to it, because even Vishnu could not give the answer. What would be the proper consideration?
It's both. Both means the sense of possession is there. In relationship, there's always a sense of possession, right? It means if you trust somebody, it means there's possession. You know what I'm saying? You're either giving or you have. Like that. So possession is there. But it's emotional possession. They're not inanimate. They're animate possession. So that means possession is emotional. Does that make sense? Because you're surrendered to them, they're surrendered to you. So that's the main point was, could he gamble her away if he's already lost? Because that was her question. Who was lost first? Is he still his own man and he's gambled me away? If she has, she wouldn't have said nothing. That was her point. But as far as she understood, he'd already lost himself, so he's in no position to gamble her away. Because his position of being lost, she's lost with him. So they're still together. That was her point. You know? And nobody could answer. You know, so only the one brother I think. Hmm? No, he was the one that survived. I think it was Vikarna. That's why I think it was Bhima or someone didn't really want to kill him. Because he had actually... Because his vow to kill all the brothers was because of this, but he was the one that supported. But because he had said he would do it, therefore it had to be done.
But that is okay according to Vedic culture, that a woman is a possession of the husband?
You're missing the point.
It's
like that. Well, let's put it the other way. Is the husband a possession of the wife?
Actually, he is.
Yes, so that's the new answer to your question. Right? Because some things have to be subtle. They can't be all gross and fit into little boxes and stuff like that. But the point is Manu makes, is that you can't separate the two. He's still responsible for him. Even if she's sold, but it means he's selling himself also. Or she's sold, meaning that she will work for someone else, you know, for free. Because there in the Vedic thing, meaning you sold yourself, means you work for the other person for free. So his wife may be working for someone else for free, but she's still his wife. And he still has to take care of her and protect her. Does that make sense? You know? Because generally these kind of things don't happen on the higher echelons of culture. But among the common people, sometimes these things happen. Right? The guy is so poor and can't pay the debt, so he sells his wife, his children. But it doesn't mean that he's not responsible. The child, then yes, he's sold and he becomes the child of the other person. But the wife is not separated. Like that. Does that make sense? But so because these things, the rule is there. But these rules are for common people. Like that. These are not rules. The dvijas wouldn't be in these situations. You know, because we see there, you know, Ram goes to the forest, his wife goes with him. Like that. Or they stay back. You know, because the Pandavas went to the forest, it doesn't mean that now Subhadra's not, she stayed in the palace. That she's not the wife. You know what I'm saying? So you just have to see what's the right situation. That makes sense? Okay. After witnessing this latest feat of the Lord's kindness upon her family, Kunti, the mother of the five Pandavas, approaches Krishna along with her sons to offer her humble obeisances. She first glorifies the Lord as the original personality, who is never affected by the qualities of the material world. He exists within and without everything, yet remains invisible to all. Speaking in a way that demonstrated the depth of both her love for the Lord and her realizations about Him, Kunti declares that Sri Krishna remains forever beyond the range of the perception of the material conditioned senses, even during His descent into the world. When he, by His causeless mercy, He permits ordinary living beings to have His darshan. Oh, okay. Meaning that he's still beyond perception, even though he may allow people to see him. That's because he allowed, not because you saw. Not by our power we see, it's by his kindness he allows. Kunti compares Lord Krishna to a Natyadhara, an actor so skillful that he is unrecognizable when he assumes a role. She wonders how, as a woman, she can possibly understand Krishna's unfathomable position, since the Lord's mission in this world is to teach bhakti yoga to advanced transcendentalists. Kunti Devi declares that all she can do is offer her obeisances unto him, who has mysteriously become the son of Vasudeva, the pleasure of Devaki, the boy of Nanda and other cowherd men of Vrindavan, and the enlivener of the cows of the senses. She then praises him for his mind-enchanting personal features. Kunti recalls how the Lord protected her and her family during their calamitous years of exile. She then asserts that only one who has no material shelter can easily approach Krishna. Note, verse 26 is important because it teaches us the fourfold meaning of material progress. Janma, good birth, Aishwarya, opulence, Shruta, education, and Sribihi, to possess beautiful bodily features. In his purport to this verse, Srila Prabhupada writes, being materially advanced means taking birth in an aristocratic family and possessing great wealth and education and attractive personal beauty. All materialistic men are mad after possessing all these material opulences, and this is known as the advancement of material civilization. But the result is that by possessing all these material assets, one becomes artificially puffed up, intoxicated by such temporary possessions. Consequently, such materially puffed up persons are incapable of uttering the holy name of the Lord by addressing him feelingly, O Govinda, O Krishna. It is said in the Shastra that by once uttering the holy name of the Lord, the sinner gets rid of a quantity of sins that he is unable to commit. Such is the power of uttering the holy name of the Lord. There is not the least exaggeration in this statement. It's very important because sometimes devotees will say, well, that's one pure chanting, because we have faith in morality. We have faith in the illusion that sin is substance or piety is substance. But what the actual point is the holy name is substance, everything else is illusion. Piety, impiety, it's all bogus. So one chanting the holy name basically clears your material existence. You know what I'm saying? The sin is gone. It says it's more than you can commit. Means it's cleared. And even anything you commit now doesn't exist. You understand? But one may ask, then why am I still not Krishna conscious? That's because our consciousness is still impure. That's how we came here, was impure consciousness. So we are conditioned to think, I am this, I am that, I have this, you know, intelligence and desires, and that's what I want, and this is what I can do. And so that is what then the chanting slowly, slowly starts breaking down, is our material identity, that we think, yes, I am this. Does that make sense? Yeah. But because of the need of being able to discriminate between this and that, right? I mean, spiritual and material. Therefore, that concept of good and bad also must be kept in place. Therefore, right and wrong. Does that make sense? So, when we become situated on transcendental, then it's all transcendental. Then there is no right, wrong, no good, bad, no... You will only be engaged in Krishna's service. You know what I'm saying? In other words, the more that one is qualified, the less restrictions are put on the person. Right? And the less qualified, the more restrictions. Does that make sense? Right? Means, it's supposed to be, let's say, people can only go to this place or that place, but the police can go everywhere. Is it supposed to be more qualified? Working for others' benefit, sense control, not working for themselves. Does that make sense? Right? So then they have that freedom to go anywhere. Right? So in the same way, it's because the devotee will only do something that's favorable to Krishna, therefore there are no rules. Because they'll always do whatever's pleasing to Krishna. Right? But until that time, as we're conditioned, then this concept of two things, the duality, is then used for the devotional advantage, that this is good for Krishna consciousness, this is bad for Krishna consciousness. So then that must be based on our concept of good and bad, moral, immoral. You know what I'm saying? It's using that as a past, as a reference point. Right? Because we can perceive that. So it's used as a reference point. Does this make some sense? Okay? So that's why it's used, and that's why it's important. You know? But at the same time, is ultimately, then it's all illusion anyways, because we think it's important, the material energy is important. Therefore, the Nishkam Karma Yoga and Daivavarna Ashram, all these different aspects are then brought forward so that we can engage that illusion that we find important in Krishna's service. Does that make sense? Not that. So it's a very subtle. That's why Bhagavatam is so special. Gita is already alluding to that, but you have 700 verses that deal with it. Then the other, you know, how do you say, 90,900. Means the other. Means in the Mahabharata, 100,000 minus 900 is not dealing on that platform. You know, and even in the Gita, it's mentioned throughout, but even sometimes it's missed. Right? Means if someone does a very in-depth study of Gita, and that many times they don't come up with the main conclusion that one of the major points is whatever we're doing, engaged in Krishna's service. So this naishkarmya is the point of Gita. Right? Because Arjuna is being taken as a madhyama. So therefore, engage in your prescribed duties without attachment, with knowledge. Right? Because Krishna is giving knowledge in the second chapter. And then Arjuna is going, great, then I can throw out all the karma. And Krishna says, no. You're going to do your work with this knowledge I've just taught you. So you're not killing the soul, you're killing the body. You know, he gets confused. Therefore, the third chapter opens with, hey, you know, what's going on? You've just told me, you know, that I'm a fool, then you're giving me this knowledge, and I'm saying, okay, with this knowledge, I'm not getting involved in all this nonsense. And then you're telling me to fight. Right? Because this whole point is that perform your activities, because you have to do an activity. Right? Rasa is attained through action. Right? Means, how do you say? Sambandha and Prayojana are experiences. You know, they're facts and experiences. Well, let's say the elements of Sambandha are, they're the players in the rasa. Right? But within Sambandha, you have the desire for interaction. Right? So that's an experience. But it's based on interaction. And the goal, prayojana, what you're going to experience from that relationship is attained through interaction. Does that make sense? So abhideya actually is the most important element. That's why the emphasis is on bhakti. Does that make sense? Karma is activity without knowledge. Jnana is knowledge without activity. Right? Bhakti means the naishkarmya means activity with knowledge. Then the abhideya is complete. And it's done in devotion, so then it becomes empowered by the Haladini potency, then it becomes bhakti. So when chit potency, both aspects of chit potency are in place, in other words, activity or karma and jnana, and it's imbued with Haladini potency, that becomes bhakti. That is the bhakti shakti. Does that make sense? Like that. So the abhideya is the focus, therefore Govindaji. Right? Therefore Rupa Goswami. Does that make sense? So Rupa is prominent, not Raghunath, because he's the Prayojana Acharya. And Marupanit is his deity, Gopinath's deity, but we hardly hear anything about him. Right? So the prominent is Govinda. Does that make sense? Okay. So the point is that we have faith that the holy name is transcendental. Anything transcendental is beyond the material existence. So chanting the holy name is beyond anything possibly you could ever do in the material world to either be bad or good. Like sometimes devotees have more faith in... that's strange. The time is over. Okay. The devotees may have more faith in a mundane moralistic activity to correct a mundane situation than in the transcendental, which is goes beyond and actually clears it. Does that make sense? So that's why Prabhupada says this. This is not an exaggeration, because that's one of the offenses, is to consider the glories of the whole. If we say one chanting clears all the sins of the universe, we may take that as a moralist, we may take that as an exaggeration. So that's an offense to the holy name. Yes?
Something that's a mistake, you have to get to a certain level before you can answer into the direct.
Yes, because chanting the holy name is direct. You can't get more direct than that. Hearing, chanting, associating with devotees, worshipping the deity, living in the Dham, these are direct. These are not indirect. You know, taking your bath, brushing your teeth, you know, these things, eating with your right hand, these are all indirect. But those are direct. Okay, so then we'll end here, and then we'll continue from here tomorrow. Like that. And then when we finish, yeah, then we'll go on. And then after this, special two-chapter one, then we will. Maharaj has prepared all these studies on the important verses, like that. So then that will be next. So then there'll be no. I mean, I think he'll give it further things, but at that time, then it'll only be this. There won't be any preparation. You don't need to. If you want to continue in the reading the chapters, please do. But if you need a break, that will be the time when you can take it. Indirect, because just because you eat with your right hand, I mean, the karmis are eating with their right hand, it doesn't mean that it's devotional service. The service, the direct, is the prasad. And then to enhance that, out of respect for Krishna, use their right hand. Like that. Yeah, because I mean, the dog doesn't use either hand. It just eats prasad. You know, so... Can we continue that tomorrow? Because I mean, these are long answers. So I'm just saying we can go through here because I have no problem. It just we discuss, go back and forth questions and this and that. So we can open with that if you can remember it tomorrow. Is this something they need to do now? Turn in their papers and okay. So essays will be turned in. Anything you need to hand out or not yet? Okay. Srila Prabhupada ki, Samaveta Bhakti Vrinda ki, Jai Nitai Gaura Premana ki.
Yeah.
No, tomorrow we'll finish this and then...